this is The Hindu on Books, a weekly podcast from India's national newspaper on the latest and the best from the world of literature.
Hello and welcome to The Hindu's Books Podcast. I'm Anand Krishnan, your host for today. In this episode, we are joined by Jairam Ramesh, who is known, of course, to many of our listeners, no doubt, as a former minister, a Rajya Sabha MP, and a leader of the Congress. But of course, Mr. Ramesh is also a very prolific author. He is the author of books including Indira Gandhi, A Life in Nature, Intertwined Lives, P.N. Huxter and Indira Gandhi, and his last book, A Checkered Brilliance, The Many Lives of V.K. Krishnamenon, underlined the thoroughness of Mr. Ramesh's research and how deep he digs into the subjects he pursues. That is very clearly evident in his latest book, which we will be discussing today. His book, The Light of Asia, The Poem That Defined the Buddha, is very unique in being the biography of a book and, of course, of the book's author. But it's very much focusing on The Light of Asia, which was an epic 1879 poem by Sir Edwin Arnold, that told the story and philosophy of the Buddha and became, in some ways, an unlikely global sensation. In this podcast, we will talk about the book, the life of Edwin Arnold, the extraordinary reach of The Light of Asia, and how it came to influence so many key 20th century figures, many of whom are very well known to those of us in India today. Thank you so much, Mr. Ramesh, for joining the podcast.
Thank you, Anand. Look forward to it.
The most obvious question I have to begin with is, it's quite an interesting subject that you've chosen. And I was just curious if you could tell our listeners what exactly it was about Edwin Arnold. Was it Edwin Arnold, the man, the life, or was it The Light of Asia that made you choose this very, very interesting path that you followed for the last few years?
Well, actually, both of them, Anand. The Light of Asia, the poem, you know, that defined the Buddha for many generations across the world, was a book that I read many years ago in the mid-60s when I was a teenager. And it remained with me. But as I, you know, grew older and got interested in political history, I realized how important the Light of Asia was to the thinking of Vivekananda, to the thinking of Tagore, to Gandhi, to Nehru, to Ambedkar, in a different way, and many others. So there was this, the impact, and you know, every Indian really is if not a Buddhist, every Indian has a Buddha in him. You know, Buddha is hardwired into the Indian DNA. I think he really is part of our existence, even though we may not define ourselves to be Buddhist in the ritualistic sense of the term. So there was that impact of the Light of Asia, the cultural impact, the political impact, the literary impact, the impact on social reformers, in different parts of the country, including Kerala and Tamil Nadu, for instance. Then, of course, the personality of Arnold. One of the most influential books which Gandhi kept with him till the very last, which he recommended to all and sundry across the world, is Arnold's translation of the Bhagavad Gita of 1885, called the Song Celestial. And in fact, Gandhi writes in his autobiography that he came to into Hinduism. He got to know about Hinduism through the Bhagavad Gita. And he got to the Bhagavad Gita through Edwin Arnold's translation, the Song Celestial. Of course, Gandhi had a completely different interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita than, for example, Bal Gangadhar Tilak, who drew a completely different lesson, or a D.D. Kosambi, you know, who had a completely different take on the Bhagavad Gita. So Edwin Arnold, you know, the principal of the Deccan College, the author of one of the well-known translations of the Gita Govinda, and of course, the two seminal works, the Song Celestial, the translation of the Bhagavad Gita, which is still in print, by the way, which still keeps getting published, and The Light of Asia, which defined the Buddha, which the Theosophical Society, even today, White Lotus Day, the death anniversary of Madame Blavatsky on the 8th of May, one of the things that gets done that day is readings from The Light of Asia.
Before we come to The Light of Asia, if I could just, you know, the story of how Edwin Arnold came to India and get interested is quite interesting. So before we discuss the poem, could you tell us a little bit about how a 25-year-old Oxford graduate ended up in Pune?
Well, he obviously pulled wires, Anand, and ended up as principal of, what became the Deccan College much later. The Pune College that became the Deccan College. And he was principal from the end of 1857 to the beginning of 1860. So he came to India as the mutiny was just, or the First War of Indian Independence, or the rebellion, depending on your point of view. But as that was winding down, so he was here at that point. He was here when the East India Company's control transited to rule by the British Crown to Queen Victoria. He obviously had a great gift for languages.
Right.
He picked up Marathi. He picked up Sanskrit in India. He would read the original Sanskrit. And later on, of course, he became well-versed in Arabic, in Persian, in Turkish, and he has poems in these languages as well. So I think, he came to India as a principal. He came to India, out of Oxford. He had demonstrated in Oxford, remarkable Catholicity of thought. Truth could be approached from different directions. Coming to India was not unknown for Englishmen belonging to his class and to his background. Mm. So he came to India, was here for, a little over 2 years, came back to India subsequently in 1886. 1886. Mm. But I think that began his lifelong. He was an imperialist to the core.
Right.
He was a Victorian imperialist to the core. But like Sir William Jones, he became an Orientalist. In fact, one of the well-known books that came out of the then Madras by G.A. Natesan and Company, a very well-known publishing company of those years, was a book called Eminent Orientalists. And one of the Eminent Orientalists there was Sir Edwin Arnold. So to the Indians of that generation, because of his translation of the Hitopadesha first, then his translation of the Gita Govinda, then The Light of Asia, and then, of course, his translation of the Bhagavad Gita as the song Celestial, created for him this great image, amongst educated Indians. And educated Indians that time meant upper caste, Indians. Normally Tamilians or Bengalis or Maharashtrians, And this, we are talking of the late 19th and early 20th century. Mm. So he was, he was steeped in Indian learning, Indian culture. He was not a scholar by any way. He was not a Max Muller. He was not a Rhys Davids, for instance. He was not a scholar in that sense of the term. He was more of a popularizer, through the Gita Govinda, through the Hitopadesha and all the other books. He really built up his reputation as somebody who interpreted works of Indic civilization, to a Western audience.
One of the things I liked about this book is it's not just about the life of Edwin Arnold and The Light of Asia. It takes you on a journey to the late 19th century, early 20th century, whole intellectual environment of how people were looking at India and how those books were received. And it's full of interesting snippets, of which I wanted to point listeners to one. This is after he finishes his two-year stint, he goes back to London and he becomes a leader, a prolific leader writer for The Telegraph. And that's when he begins all these works that you mentioned that sort of launch him as a well-known author, including his book, his translation of the Hitopadesha. And then you have the collection in 1875. And there's this great quote that you pulled out of The Telegraph and how Karl Marx described it, which really made me chuckle. Where he says, quote, "By means of a hidden and artificial sewer system, all the lavatories of London spew their physical filth into the Thames. And by means of the systematic pushing of the goose quill, the world capital spews out all the social filth into the great papered central sewer called the Daily Telegraph." So that's part of the contradictions of Edwin Arnold that you mentioned, which I found interesting, where on the one hand, he does seem to have empathy and affinity for Indian thought, for Indian philosophical traditions. But then on the other hand, he's this guy who's very much at home as a leader writer of The Telegraph. And as you said, he has very problematic views in many ways of empire and of, quote unquote, the natives as well. So how does he sort of inhabit both those worlds?
Well, he was a liberal imperialist, no doubt. He was the quintessential Victorian. You know, he believed in Britain's manifest destiny. He believed in ultimate self-rule by Indians. Right. But for him, Indians meant Brahmins, really. You know, his universe was either Maharashtrian Brahmins or Tamil Brahmins or Bengali Brahmins. He was a believer in the manifest destiny of Britain, on the civilizing role of Britain. But he realized that India was heir to an enormously rich and diverse cultural legacy. Mm. Buddhist, Hindu, Islam. You know, he had a book on Allah's names, and he also had books in, which translated Persian works into English. So he knew about, he was very sensitive. I mean, as I said, he's like he was the William Jones in many ways, you know. And like Max Müller, I mean, none of these guys, were great exponents of independence for India from Britain. At most, perhaps dominion status, but even dominion status much later. So politically, he was a Tory. You know, he was against home rule, even for Ireland, for that matter. Mm. You know, he was a Benjamin Disraeli fan. He believed in expansionism and British rule. But as I said, he was very conscious and very aware of India's cultural legacy. And I think he was one of the people who, in late 19th century Victorian England, brought Indian literature. And what better examples of Indian literature then Mahabharata, which he translated, Hitopadesha, which he translated, Gita Govinda, which he translated, and of course, the Bhagavad Gita, which he translated. And because of the centrality of London in the late 19th century and early 20th century, his influence in London reverberated across the Atlantic in the United States and also spread in Europe. The way things worked then, when works became hits in London, they automatically became hits in Calcutta, Madras, Bombay, and places like this. So he was, you're absolutely right. He was an imperialist in today's language. I mean, you know, he has been deconstructed. There have been books written on him and he was an unabashed champion of empire, which he was. But at the same time, he was, what I found very interesting was that he was steeped into popularizing and propagandizing virtually the literary and cultural heritage of India and Persia to some extent. And of course, there was a time in the later part of his life when he became a great admirer of Japanese culture. Mm. But India remained with him throughout his life.
But it is also interesting that the many fans that he had, from Mahatma Gandhi to Nehru to Tagore, who were able to kind of separate his personal views on imperialism, on empire to some degree from his
Raman,
works.
C.V. Raman, you know, just imagine the man who won the Nobel Prize, India's first Nobel Prize for Science in 1930, one of the greatest scientists the world has ever seen. And, you know, he writes that, you know, he was influenced, extraordinarily influenced by three books. You know, Helmholtz's book on physics, Euclid's book on geometry, and Arnold's Light of Asia. So it's not just an influence on Vivekananda, Ramakrishna, Tagore, Gandhi, Nehru, and political personalities or public figures, but also on a person like C.V. Raman, you know, which you would not normally expect. I mean, on the one hand, Rudyard Kipling was a great bhakt of Edwin Arnold. On the other, C.V. Raman. And could they, I mean, they're two diametrically opposed personalities, Rudyard Kipling and C.V. Raman.
But it is interesting that people were able to separate the man from his works, which is something that I think doesn't happen in this century.
I was conscious of the fact, you know, I was conscious of the fact that I'm writing about a period, you know. It's very easy to be retrospective on it. And even in my previous books, in my political biographies, I've not been judgmental. You know, my role as a writer is to bring out the times.
Absolutely.
And he was living in the 19th century. He was living, he died in 1904, so he cannot be considered a 20th century figure.
Yeah.
He's certainly a 19th century figure. He was a Victorian figure in every sense of the term. So that was an era, the Victorian era. There was benevolence, there was patronizing, you know, there was a sense of, as I said, the British duty to make India fit for rule by itself. And he has, you know, he said ultimately the British have to get out of India. But he never, you know, never gave a deadline. You know, it could have been 100 years, it could have been 200 years. So he was, to that way, he was very much a symbol of British Empire in India.
There's so much more to get into in this book, and I think some we will leave for listeners to discover in the book, such as his return to India, the role he played in rediscovering, in a way, Bodh Gaya. But before
The Bodh Gaya dispute, Anant, you know, like the Ayodhya dispute, you know, the Hindu-Muslim dispute in Ayodhya, there was for almost 60, 70 years a dispute between Hindus and Buddhists, and there still is. I mean, many Ambedkar organizations are not happy with the compromise that was worked out by Rajendra Prasad and Nehru and Sri Krishna Sinha, you know, which gave control over the Bodh Gaya temple, the Mahabodhi temple, you know, to a committee in which you have half of them are Buddhists and half of them are Hindus. So that was an agitation that went on. It got settled only in May 1953. It went on for almost 60 years, and it was triggered by Arnold's visit to Bodh Gaya, you know, in January, late January of 1886, where he wrote about how anguished he felt after seeing the manner in which the Shaivite priests, the Mahant, was dealing with the Mecca, the Jerusalem of Buddhism. And, you know, of course, he was wrong because, you know, Bodh Gaya was sacred to both the Hindus as well as the Buddhists. So he bought a certain Christian binary, you know, it had to be either Hindu or Buddhist. You know, like Mecca is only Muslim. Jerusalem, you know, at that time was seen, you know, for Christians, not realizing that it's sacred to three faiths, not just to one faith. So he, his columns, his agitation led to the Bodh Gaya dispute.
Right.
And, you know, the Bodh Gaya dispute kept India's Buddhist heritage, you know, very much in public focus. In fact, Anand, the man who really brought Buddhism back into India, of course, you know, we associate Ambedkar's conversion to Buddhism in 1956. But, you know, that was a political act. But the man who restored Buddhism to the center of Indian culture, I would argue, and this may many people may not agree with me, I would argue, was Anagarika Dharmapala, the Sinhalese monk who spent most of his life in Calcutta with the Mahabodhi Society, which he founded. And it was thanks to Anagarika Dharmapala that not only Bodh Gaya, but later on Sarnath, gets, redone, refurbished, re-established. And so to Anagarika Dharmapala, who in many ways was influenced tremendously by Edwin Arnold, we owe, the recovery of Buddhism as part of our cultural heritage.
So, of course, The Light of Asia itself is a thread that holds this book together. And as you say, it has 8 books, and they go over the birth of Siddhartha, they go over his life, and of course, his work and his philosophy as well. Could we at this point get you to give us a flavor of some of The Light of Asia, perhaps the 8th book?
Let me say one thing, Anand, that Arnold was very much in the traditional historiography of the life of the Buddha. It was not a book, Light of Asia is not a book on Buddhism. It's not a book on Buddhist thought or Buddhist philosophy. It's a book on Buddha, the life of Buddha. And I think that's what, and I end the book by saying that the reason why the book became such a sensation was because it focused on the humanity of Buddha, not the divinity of Buddha. Because humanity unites, divinity divides. And I think that's what really explains the fact that The Light of Asia became such a tremendous sensation across the world and across cultures. His Light of Asia is embedded in the traditional historiography of Prince Siddhartha seeing an old man, seeing a cripple, seeing a corpse, and seeing a monk. But as you know, this traditional historiography was challenged by Ambedkar. And before Ambedkar, it had been challenged by India's greatest scholar of Pali and Buddhism in the early part of the 20th century, Dharmanand Kosambi, the father of the great D.D. Kosambi. And that was a completely different historiography. It was the political economy and the reasons why Buddha gave up, life and sought enlightenment was not because of the four sides, but because of disputes, between two tribes and two clans. The fact is that one should distinguish Ambedkar's, fascination with the Light of Asia from Gandhi, Vivekananda, Tagore, Nehru, and so many others. There is also Sri Narayana Guru in Kerala. There is Jyoti Das in Tamil Nadu, Lakshmi Narasu in Tamil Nadu. These were all social reformers. So they took out from the Light of Asia. The Light of Asia first got translated into Bengali. That was not in a social reformist translation. It was something that was very much part of culture. And Ramakrishna and Vedanta and Vivekananda then popularized it. But, there was an early translation into Tamil by A. Madhavaya. There was a translation into Malayalam. In 1910, then subsequently in 1914. Light of Asia became, the message of the Light of Asia was social equity, the obliteration of caste distinctions, Buddha did not accept the caste system, which the Brahmins preached. Different people took different things out of the Light of Asia. That's what I want to very much highlight. Well, it has 8 books and 5,300 lines, 41,000 words in the Light of Asia. You want me to read the last few lines from the Light of Asia, Anand?
I thought what would be interesting is if you could just give our listeners a flavor of what this was about. And I thought the last few lines that you mentioned in your book.
There are 8 books on the life of the Buddha. The final book, Book the 8th, is really the crux of the Light of Asia. And this is the book that captured the world's imagination. It contains the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Rules, and the doctrines of Karma and Nirvana. And I think the closing lines were perhaps the most evocative and resonated across countries, across cultures, across languages. It got translated into multiple European languages, multiple Asian languages, multiple South Asian languages. And it ends thus. Here endeth what I write, who love the master for his love of us. A little knowing, little have I told, touching the teacher and the ways of peace. 45 reigns thereafter showed he those in many lands and many tongues, and gave our Asia light that still is beautiful. Conquering the word with spirit of strong grace, all of which is written in the holy books, and where he passed, and what proud emperors carved his sweet words upon the rocks and caves. The Buddha died, the great Tathagata, even as a man amongst men, fulfilling all. And how 1,000 crores since then have tread the path which leads where he went unto Nirvana, where the silence lives. And finally, of course, he ends. Ah, blessed world, O high deliverer, forgive this feeble script which doth thee wrong, measuring with little with thy lofty love. Ah, lover, brother, guide, lamp of the law, I take my refuge in thy name and thee. I take my refuge in thy law of good. I take my refuge in thy order, Om. The dew is on the lotus. Rise, great sun, and lift my leaf and mix me with the wave. Om Mani Padme Hum. The sun rises, comes, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. And that's how this fantastic poem really ends.
On that note, I think it's a good way to end this conversation as well, Mr. Ramesh. Thank you so much for speaking with us and also for this book. It's really quite an interesting journey of both the man and more than that of the work and how it spread all over the world in the 20th century. There's lots more we didn't get into. I wanted to get your thoughts on how it went to China, to Japan. We'll save that for another conversation. But thank you so much for joining the Hindu podcast today. Jairam Ramesh, the author of The Light of Asia, the poem that defined the Buddha.
Thank you, Anand. Delight to be with you.
Thank you for listening to The Hindu on Books. You can now find The Hindu's podcasts such as In Focus and Parlay on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher and other major platforms. Write to us with comments and feedback at socmed4@thehindu.co.in.